Hey, nice to see you again. This is Richard Sachs on Lost Arts Radio. This is Lost Arts Radio Live for the 7th day of March in 2020. And we've got a lot going on. Most of the attention on the news during the week, as I'm sure you guys know, is on the whole coronavirus situation, and specifically this novel engineered coronavirus, because the coronavirus in general is a big family of microorganisms that are associated with very common health situations like cold and regular flu and stuff like that. This one is special. It was made for us with tax money and university help and sold to China and released out of there. And now we get to deal with it. And a lot of the questions and situations that are arising in the world right now are as a result of that. And as with most of the programs that are operating by our rulers, it's very complex, and it has a lot of objectives. It's not an accident. It so far looks like it's achieving what it's designed to achieve, and so we're thinking about responses and solutions to that, because really the only reason I found to investigate any of these things and find out what's going on and what the problems are and what our global and national rulers are doing along with their destruction agenda, which I spent decades digging into, is to find out what would be a positive solution so that for everybody's sake, we can turn it around in a good direction. And we're working on a project for that right now to get real information to people in positions of global and corporate power that, you know, the ones that are just working for the system and they're kind of brainwashed into believing everything they hear from the government agencies because of their education and because of the media, and anybody who questions any of that is considered to be, you know, crazy and misinformed and giving bad information and things like that, when the reality is just the opposite. There are people giving some bad information on purpose, but the vast majority of those are official position people, you know, that are trying to get everybody ready to fall into the drug trap. And really, there are much better ways to go. And the people that cannot any longer be mentioned, because we don't want to be knocked off the air everywhere, are reminding us that there are natural things in the plant kingdom called herbs. You've probably heard of them, that have an antiviral effect. And I was just listening to a great presentation by our friend Mike, whose last name must not be mentioned, and he was saying, yeah, he's listing all these different herbs that are very effective, and they've been used for thousands of years, not because people didn't have drugs, but because they were smarter than that, and they knew that real medicine has no negative effects at all. Calling them side effects is just completely misleading. They're actually just the real effects, and they shouldn't be negative, and they shouldn't hurt you, and they probably shouldn't even kill you. You know, that's not real medicine. So real medicine is fortunately provided by God and nature, and it's all around, and we're so detached and disconnected that mostly we don't even remember what any of those things are. We tend to think that everything in nature is now poisonous and it has to come in a bottle to be safe. But that's not exactly right. You still have to learn, you know, what are the properties of each of the different plants out there. But there are a lot of them that are really valuable and have strong antiviral characteristics with no danger at all if they're used correctly. And they wouldn't kill masses of people like the synthetic toxic chemicals that are called medicine often do, and typically do all the time. And one of the dangers of this situation is the damage that will be caused by that kind of a response. So what we're doing in response to this whole situation is trying to put together a presentation that can be like a collection of experts giving their insight on different aspects of all this, and then on potential solutions that are harmless and that work. And there are those, and they're not even expensive for the most part. So one of the things we wanted to include in that overview and that package that we're trying to put together as quickly as we possibly can, hopefully to get to all levels of the government, is we wanted a realistic history of recent pandemics that preceded the current one. And a friend of ours has studied those in considerable depth and been involved in the responses to several. And that's our attorney friend, Ralph Pusatola, who is a trustee of Natural Solutions Foundation. And I think he's the founder and president, we have to see if I'm right, of the Institute of Health Research, and we're going to hear about those. Our time's going to go really fast, as always, in this show. It's not really very long, and I'm going to give most of the time just to him to explain what he wants to touch on the history of pandemics that have preceded the current one. The current one's not fake, by the way. It's manufactured, but it's real. So that's another thing that we'll go into in some detail, not on this show, but on future ones and in the Planetary Healing Club meeting, which follows this broadcast a half an hour later. I'm just trying to add Ralph to the show here. Let me see. Hopefully I do this correctly. Let's see what happens. We'll know in just a second here. It says that he's being added. Come on, Ralph. Are you there?
All right.
Hey, Ralph. Have I got you on Skype? Yeah, I can even see you. That's great.
Hey.
You must be on a phone, right, rather than a laptop?
I'm on a phone, yes.
Can you turn it 90 degrees so that we have a better view?
Well, I turned off my camera because I always have terrible... let me see if I can get it back on. I don't even know. Yeah, I get it back on, sure.
I've got sound in the background, too, like a radio or something on.
I'm watching Fox News. I'm watching Liberty and Levin. Let me turn the sound off.
Okay.
All right.
So I just gave you... You probably didn't hear it, but I was just introducing you to everybody. And am I right that you're the founder and president of the Institute of Health Research?
I'm the president of it. It was actually founded by Dr. Podell and Karen Horvath. I was the third trustee. And when they both retired, I guess I inherited the presidency.
Okay. All right. Sounds great. Well, our time's going to go really fast. And so what I told people you would be doing was giving them a little bit of context, you know, to the current pandemic by looking at previous ones in the relatively recent past. And anything that you'd like to educate us about, those that would give us more understanding of what's happening now and what the pattern looks like.
Are you recording this, or is it?
Yeah, we're recording and we're broadcasting live.
All right. I would love to do this in the other room where I can get at some information.
Sure.
But it's probably, let me see, if I can even remember where I'm going to be able to get it. Let's start. I think I have enough memory here that I can do it. I don't think we need to, for example, give folks a list of the great pandemics of the past 2,000 years. Let it suffice to say that approximately every 500 to 700 years, there is a major pandemic that rages through Eurasia. And now in the modern world, of course, with Eurasia being connected to the New World and places in between, there are no barriers to pandemics, although there is some evidence that even the Black Plague managed to spread into the New World at one point. So we can tell you that approximately every 700 years, there has been a serious plague that has ravaged the human race. Of course, we all know of the Great Plague, the Black Death of 1346, but it was about 700 years before that, the plague of Justinian, and about 700 years before that, there was another plague basically during the Roman Republic period. In each case, between a quarter and a third, and possibly up to a half, of the human population of Eurasia died within 1 or 2 years. And that's an important thing to remember. 700 years after the Black Death, and remember the Black Death and the plague came back and back and back, all the way during the 1300s through the 1700s, until really the modern era, when modern hygiene, sanitation, and of course nutrition made a big difference in in human living conditions and the human immune system prior to the attack on our immune system that is represented most obviously by environmental toxins and vaccine-induced toxins. But about 700 years after 1346 brings us to 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. There was no great plague in the middle of the 19th century, but in the beginning of the 20th century, of course, we had the first, if you will, cooked up pandemic, the great 1918-1919 influenza that killed more people than World War I killed. Here in the United States, 500,000 Americans died in those 2 years, while only 50,000 Americans were killed on the battlefields of World War I. And it is instructive to look at the great pandemic that began the 20th century in order to understand a little more about the nature of pandemics. And I say it was the first manufactured or weaponized pandemic in human history, although we do have examples of, for example, Native Americans being given...
That was a smallpox situation, right?
Being given smallpox-infected blankets and trade goods in order specifically to kill them. You know, it was population control. However, what happened in 1918 is quite instructive. We start with the fact that the United States was ramping up its involvement in World War I, and hundreds of thousands of Americans were being trained for the military. They were being trained generally out in the Midwest and in the Plain States at a series of Army bases. These were basic training bases, and very similar. They're the same ones were basically used a couple of decades later and then World War II. But in World War I, two very interesting things happened at one time. A group of these soldiers, a large group of them, were given a so-called experimental live virus flu vaccine. And at the same time, when they came down with the reactions to the flu vaccine, namely fevers and things like that, they were given the new miracle drug, aspirin, to control the fevers. The soldiers who had then been exposed to a live flu virus were loaded onto trains with their horses and with the pigs and chickens that would be slaughtered to feed them. And all of these mammals in close quarters were shipped out to South Carolina, where again, it was noted that these soldiers were recovering from the vaccine reactions, and everybody, horses, pigs, cows, soldiers, were all loaded onto these transport ships, which took several weeks to cross the Atlantic Ocean to Spain, where the American soldiers were offloaded and put onto basically live fire type drills. They were actually exposed, among other things, to mustard gas as part of their training to prepare them for the battlefields of World War I. Within weeks, this terrible flu epidemic broke out in Spain, the famous Spanish flu. The American soldiers began dying. They would get sick, begin to recover slightly with the aspirin, and then drop dead. It was noted during that time period that it was quite strange that the flu normally killed off young children and old people, but this flu was killing people off in the prime of life. So if you wanted to cook up a very dangerous influenza, you would be essentially cooking it up by mixing together a live virus vaccine with all sorts of other mammals that can cook up interesting recombinations of the same viruses. And then you would subject the people to all sorts of stresses, like being jammed together in a ship and being put to war games on the plain, on the, you know, the plains of Madrid or wherever it might have been, subjecting them to actually mustard gas. So you add it all up, and it's no wonder that the great flu pandemic of 1918-1919 killed all those people. It's almost inevitable that that sort of thing should happen. It's almost inevitable that China's one bioweapons level four laboratory would be in Wuhan, and they would be testing out coronavirus weaponization on a certain species of bat. And some of those bats would end up in the so-called wet market in Wuhan. And all of a sudden, we have a worldwide pandemic being triggered. Was it intentional? Did the Chinese government do it to test out the potency of the weapon? Was it unintentional? Because let me tell you, no matter how careful you are at these things, nobody is ever careful enough. Or did someone in the resistance release it in order to possibly bring down the Communist Party? I'm not sure that I can tell you that we know, but these are among the possibilities of what's just happened. So that's a sort of nutshell history, if you will, of the great pandemics that rushed through Eurasia and have had such an important impact on human species. And it's not just the pandemics themselves, but you know, there is an interesting theory that compares Eurasia on one hand with its climate bands that run from east to west all the way across the continent to the climate bands of Africa and North and South America, which also run north and, you know, east and west, but they run through continents that are essentially oriented north and south. And so, for example, while the domestication of certain animals in Eurasia took literally a generation or so to spread across the entire continent, it took 1,000 years for domestications to spread in North and South America. The same thing applies to diseases. The diseases of Eurasia were constantly sloshing about, and the populations of Eurasia were becoming immune to them, while the populations of North America, South America, and Africa were not becoming immune to these viruses. And of course, we know from history that literally, as the conquistadors were coming into the New World, their diseases were rushing ahead of them and decimating the populations. The Mississippi Valley, which had millions of Native Americans living in it, in villages and towns and ceremonial centers, was basically emptied by the time DeSoto was going up the Mississippi River and noting that there were these empty villages in wreck. The Aztec Empire suffered a great plague just before Cortez, and the Incas suffered a great plague just before the conquistadors.
Well, so how did it get to them if it was before because Europeans came over?
Because explorers and traders and other and people are just moving around. It's not just the armies that are moving around; it's the people who are hanging on and moving ahead. And yes, it does appear that the disease literally travels faster than the army does. And so that's another important point to note of the way these interactions happen. And today, with our modern transportation, it's even more so. For example, that ship that's now off the coast of San Francisco. Right. It went from San Francisco to Hawaii and back. Nowhere near the areas where COVID is becoming pandemic. Yet there was a person who had been in Asia, who was in Hawaii, who has the virus, and some people on the ship came off the ship in Hawaii and somehow picked up the virus and brought it back to the ship. And now 27 people on the ship have tested positive, and they're going to take the big mistake of quarantining everyone on the ship, which means that everybody on the ship is eventually going to get it. Right. This particular virus is extremely virulent. That is, it is easy to catch it. If you have a suppressed immune system, and who doesn't these days? If you have a suppressed immune system and you're anywhere exposed to it, you are going to pick it up. And it's going to, and unlike Ebola and other, and the common flu, which actually shows symptoms before or as people become contagious, this particular coronavirus does not show symptoms while people have become contagious, but only days after they become contagious. And therefore, it is much easier to spread. So so we have modern communications spreading it. We have these ideas of somehow pulling people into a quarantine station and jamming them together so they all get sick as something that makes sense, which it doesn't. You know, quarantining at home, it's called self-sheltering or sheltering at home, is a far safer thing to do for people who might have symptoms. It is even crazier that the CDC saying, if you've had your flu vaccine and have flu-like symptoms, you probably have COVID-19, as though the flu vaccine worked. By the way, this is the very year when the CDC also admitted that it was no more than 20% effective.
So well, now you said that if you've had the flu shot,
right, and you have symptoms, you can assume it's COVID. Well, actually, you can assume it's the flu because
the regular flu, right? Because it couldn't be anything else.
Okay. Well, it could be COVID, of course, but the interesting part is that the flu vaccine, if it's effective at all, and no, that's a good question, the CDC says it's only 18 to 20% effective, which means it's less than 50-50. I mean, you know, you might as well roll the dice and see what happens. So right. We have this strange thing going on where the public health authorities are doing all the wrong steps. Some of the things they're doing are worse than nothing. What they should be doing, and some of the things they're doing are correct. You know, wash your hands and all that stuff is good. You know, we know that it was improved nutrition, hygiene, and sanitation that ended the great epidemic diseases of earlier centuries. Clearly, I mean, I can show you charts that show 90% reductions in all of those diseases, whether it was smallpox or typhus or scarlet fever or diphtheria, the same downward curve throughout the 19th century. And then you look at the same charts and see where vaccines were first introduced for those various diseases, and you see that the actual decline leveled off at that point and went down slower. And by the way, for the diseases that never had a vaccine, like scarlet fever, the exact same curve on those charts, very instructive charts. And we now see, when you look very closely at the measles record, a series of sine waves running through the record now, where it peaks and goes down as the measles become more adapted to the various vaccine forms, and so of course none of the vaccines really stopped the diseases. What stopped the diseases were, as I said, nutrition, hygiene, and sanitation. And what will protect people from COVID-19 are the same things. And of course, in my opinion, the most powerful piece of immune system stimulation that you can use is nano silver. Now, of course, vitamin D3 is essential, and vitamin C is essential, and N-acetylcysteine, NAC, very powerful and useful. But most of all, it's nano silver. Nano silver is really important, and of course, my good friend Dr. Rima Lebo, MD, strongly recommends nano silver, and you can get the nano silver she recommends if you go to her shopping cart, which is at www.NSF, that's Natural Solutions Foundation, right? NSFmarketplace.com. Very important place. So what do we have here? We have a situation in which I'm sorry, guys. Am I still on or have I just bumped off?
No, you're on.
I have my camera still on?
Yeah. Okay, we can see.
Why that happened. That's very odd. All right. Well, you can see me, so I will assume everything's fine.
Yeah, did your picture disappear? You can't see us anymore?
Can't see you guys anymore. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to just press this button, hope I don't knock this off. Oh, there we are. Now, if I hit this, it'll bring me back up, I'll bet. There we go. All right. But am I there? I guess I'm there. Yeah. All right. I love these new technologies, and I hope the family room here is not too much of a mess. But
no. Just don't put the self-destruct sequence button. Just don't push that one.
I don't want to. I don't want to blow up the entire planet yet.
Important safety. Yeah,
so we've talked a little bit about this issue of the history of pandemics and what's going on right here and right now, and those are good things to talk about. But let's also talk about the history of martial law in America, because a lot of people are talking about martial law.
Yeah.
They're really concerned that there's going to be forced vaccination in a year or so when the vaccine is available. And by the way, the latest announcement that I saw today was that the Chinese claim they will have a valid and working vaccine within a month. Now, that's, of course, impossible. It will not be a working vaccine. No vaccine really works. What? But it will be very dangerous because
And it could be that quick because what I had heard, Ralph, is that one had been patented before the outbreak of the virus.
The U.S. government owns a patent. Yes.
Yeah. How can you patent something that's not already developed? So maybe they had it developed already, you know.
Indeed. Maybe this is a weaponized disease that either got out of hand or was live tested and that got out of hand, or somebody in the resistance decided to pull a 13th monkey on us and release it into Wuhan. The world will long remember the wet meat market in Wuhan, I am sure. We should all remember that there are consequences to what we do, and there are consequences to the twists and turns of our cultures.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about this issue of can we expect armed agents of the public health authorities to come to our doorsteps with needles? Is that likely to happen? And you remember, the public health service is a uniformed service. We have a surgeon general and other persons with military rank and actually wear military uniforms on dress occasions. And right. So we can talk about this in the context of martial law. We have examples of martial law in U.S. history, and we also have the limitations on martial law that are clearly set out in the history of our legal system. And so I begin with reference to the U.S. Constitution. Well, actually, let's go back a step further. Let's begin with the Declaration of Independence. And let's remember the Declaration includes, of course, general statements about human rights mm-hmm. and general statements about the nature of government and its limitations. And then it goes on, and in a whole large section, it lists all of the evil things that the King of England and his minions have done to the American people, and justifying, of course, independence. And among those evil things were basically imposing martial law. The city of Boston was taken over by the British military and lived under martial law until the Revolutionary Army forced the British Army out. The city of New York was taken over by the British military and lived under martial law. And people were executed at a drumhead court without judicial process. So the American people were very much aware when the Constitution was written about the nature of martial law. And nowhere in the Constitution is the federal government of the United States given authority to declare martial law. In fact, we know from the way the Constitution is written that unless it is explicitly in there, it is not a power of the central government. Now, there is a reference in the Constitution to the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. The writ of habeas corpus is an ancient writ. A writ is a formal court document, right? It's an ancient writ that says basically by a judge to a government agent, bring me the body, habeas corpus, have me the body.
Yeah.
The body is a person who's being held by the government under some manner of duress. And it's the most powerful writ of all because it says no matter who you are, whether you're the king's agent or the president's agent, if as a judge, I am telling you, bring the person before me, that we may decide whether you may lawfully hold this person. And the person must be physically brought before the court. The Constitution says the writ can be suspended. And indeed, during the Civil War, it was suspended. But let me tell you that the courts made some decisions about that are significant. But before we get to that, let's remind everyone that the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus does not suspend your legal rights. Indeed, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, were adopted after the Constitution and after the habeas corpus clause, which means that those amendments amend the habeas corpus clause. If it ever allowed the government to cut short our rights, it did not do so after the Bill of Rights was adopted.
Let me ask you one question interjected in there, Ralph, and that's just to be clear on the habeas corpus issue. You said, bring me the body or have me the body. Is that the body of the accused or the body of evidence that has to be seen to make charges?
No, it is the person. The actual person must be brought before the judge. The judge has to see the living person.
In order to make charges or to do what?
In order to justify the government holding that person.
Okay.
And the government has the burden of proof that it has the legal right to hold that person.
So, well, then how can they issue the orders that say go arrest somebody, issuing an arrest warrant, when they typically don't have the person?
That's the basis for the arrest in the first place, is the arrest warrant. A judge signs the warrant. You can't arrest someone without a judge. And the judge signs the warrant, and then the person is brought before the judge to justify the seizure. And if they've been seized without judicial process, the same process allows the court to force the government to produce the body. Now, during the Civil War, a lot of people were arrested and held without due process of law. And that was done by the federal government, even though the Constitution says you can't do that. And there were cases that came up to the Supreme Court after the war, and the famous case is the Mulligan case, and the court held basically that you can only have martial law literally on the battlefield. You can only have that drumhead court at the officers meeting and hanging people on an actual battlefield. That so long as the civil courts are capable of meeting, there can be no martial law. Clear decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. My question is, if we are ordered to close all of our courts and public places because of a pandemic, does that now apply? Or can we be subject to martial law because the civil courts no longer are capable of meeting? This is a very troubling issue that needs to be considered.
Right.
And I was interviewing Larry B. Kraft, Counsel B. Kraft, who is, in my estimation, the Dean of the Patriot Lawyers. Certainly one of the great, great patriot lawyers of our era. Just yesterday on this issue, and we are both very troubled about it. And it would be really good if people could organize a team of lawyers to be ready to test this in court, probably by going into the federal circuit court in Washington, D.C., and trying to get an appellate division decision as soon as possible. That will take some
before
money.
They say before the courts are stopped from operating, obviously.
Exactly. You got it. And it's my hope that the Chief Justice Roberts will make the decision that the courts can operate electronically and the judge can be at home. Skype.
That's exactly. It's working at the moment. So I think there's another issue, though, that really needs to be looked at that wasn't apparently thought of by the founders, and that's that the federal government, and sometimes, you know, in many cases the state governments too, but the federal government for sure, has established the traditional habit now of delegating powers that it doesn't have to agencies that don't have a constitutional basis to exist. Some of those are called health agencies. And it's also made agreements voluntarily on behalf of the people to join a supranational organization that then has rules that the members by default agree to, and they basically become the government if the right kind of emergency is declared.
We do have laws in the U.S. Constitution that says that the treaties and laws made pursuant to the Constitution are the law of the land, and among those treaties are the treaties that established the World Health Organization. Yes. But of course, it's the treaties and made in accordance with the Constitution. The federal government could not make a treaty that would violate the First or Second Amendment. To do so would be to violate the First or Second Amendment.
The problem is they already did that. Joining these organizations, they agree to give up the First, Fourth, Fifth, Tenth, you know, and other amendments. And that's the agreement that they voluntarily made on our behalf. The fact that it's unconstitutional, I don't think that's been brought up so far. I mean, not
it hasn't been tested. But it can't be tested until they actually try to shut down websites. You know, for the government, not private people shutting them down. I mean, unfortunately, we have a situation where we have a tremendous private censorship going on. Although I personally believe that those folks who are using our internet public utility for commercial purposes and are then restricting our speech over that public utility are acting as agents of government power. They're acting under color of law, and they should be bound by the same First Amendment that the government is bound by, because they are alter egos for the government in that context.
Right.
And I believe that that it's really important to make sure that the public roads, as it were, are available to all people to use. The public paid for the roads, and we should have access to them. And that includes the internet highway, as it were,
yeah.
Which is to me a type of common ground or commons held for everyone's benefit. And while you can use your commercial benefit, you should not be able to restrict people just because you disagree with their speech. That's to me an important factor. So let's talk a little bit about how the mandates might be implemented.
Okay.
The federal government doesn't go around with agents with needles sticking them in people's bodies. They actually go about and use the state governments for that. And it will be the state governments that will be going from door to door, perhaps. And we have some cases about that. We have a very important case from 2013. And that case is Missouri versus McNeely. Get right over there. And in that case, McNeely got into a one-car accident. He slammed into a tree or something like that. And he was rushed to an emergency room. And as he's being wheeled in on the gurney, strapped with a gurney, the police officer on one side of him is saying to the orderly on the other side, "I want you to get his blood right away. I want to see how much alcohol he's got." And McNeely is saying, and I imagine in a slurred voice, "Don't take my blood. I don't consent." Well, they take his blood, they arrest him for drunk driving and convict him. And his appeal gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow.
I don't know how. I would love to know how. That was
great
lawyering, you know. And the Supreme Court says the police officer could have picked up a phone, gotten a local judge within moments, and could have gotten that judge to issue a search warrant allowing them to take the blood without the individual's consent. It could have been done within minutes. And he didn't do it, and McNeely did not consent. And hold on one second, Kathy, I'm on a radio show. Okay. Very good. I'm back, folks. And he didn't consent, and therefore the taking of his blood was unlawful. Or as the court said, and this is an almost exact quote, "We have never wavered from our commitment that the individual has a protected privacy interest in preventing an agent of the state from piercing the skin." So can a government agent go to your door with a needle? Not according to McNeely. There was a subsequent case, by the way, last year, where the person was unconscious and couldn't say, "I refuse to consent." And the court said it was okay to take that person's blood because they didn't refuse to consent. Unless you assert your right of informed consent, the right will be deemed waived. That's the most important legal point I can raise in this podcast, is unless you assert your right, it is deemed waived. You must assert it. How do you assert your right of informed consent? Well, that leads us to the issue of what is informed consent. And in order to do that, we have to talk about a couple of cases. We have to talk about the 1905 case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which is the case that in which the Supreme Court said it's okay for a state government to fine you $5. In those days, $5, five silver dollars would be about $100 today. And it's okay to fine you if you do not get a vaccine during a declared pandemic. They didn't say it's okay to stick a needle in your arm against your will, right? They said it's okay to fine you. And then they went on and they said, however, the courts are not without power to intervene if it can be shown with probability that this person is not a fit subject for vaccination, or that the vaccination may cause harm or probably death. And that, of course, was 1905, before we really knew how dangerous vaccines were. In the subsequent decades, our courts have held that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. And so we are in a situation where, in order to force you to be vaccinated, it would seem to me that a judge has to have a hearing, has to find out about your health, and has to decide whether you're a fit subject to vaccination, or you have to volunteer. If you say, "I don't consent," they have to get that sort of judicial process. Now, a few years after Jacobson, is another famous case decided by Judge Cardozo, who was a New York State judge at the time, later became a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And that case was about a doctor who engaged in a medical intervention without the informed consent of the patient. And the court held that to do so is a trespass, an assault and battery, subjects the doctor to liability in tort, even if the person is not harmed by the intervention. So long as it was without consent, it's an assault and battery. And that's been the law ever since.
Okay, what interaction is there between that decision and precedent and what was signed in 1986 under Reagan?
It's considered the leading case in informed consent in the United States, the first case. And of course, you know, a half a century later, at the end of World War II, were the famous Nuremberg trials, where the chief Nazi war criminals were tried and punished. And after the Nuremberg trials themselves, the International Tribunal was done, there were a series of what are called the subsequent Nuremberg trials. Among those subsequent Nuremberg trials, which were held by the United States as occupying power, were the famous was the famous Nazi doctors trial. And for the Nazi doctors trial, the U.S. prosecutors team, which, by the way, was led by a member of the U.S. Supreme Court who was on leave of absence for the purpose of being a prosecutor, they prepared a document called the Nuremberg Code. And the Nuremberg Code was a statement of the existing law of informed consent. And it said that the voluntary informed consent of the subject of any medical intervention is absolutely necessary, that no element of coercion may be used to force anyone to undergo any medical intervention. And it was on the basis of that Nuremberg Code that the Nazi doctors were tried and some of them hung. The law is clear. And the same language, that paragraph about no element of coercion, has been taken up and is in United States laws. There's something called an institutional review board law, which says that any experiments must go through institutional review boards, and the board's job is to make sure that informed consent is real. And then the UN Bioethics Convention uses the same language as well. Clearly, international law is set and settled. You have a right to informed consent, but if you do not assert that right, the right may be deemed waived, will be deemed waived. Silence is consent. Now, if you want to assert your right to informed consent, one of the best ways of doing that is with what is called an advanced medical directive. It's a medical will or goes by a number of different terms, and it doesn't have to be a single document. For example, we know people who have cards on them that say, "I am a diabetic," as a warning, or right. "I do not accept transfusions." People who are Jehovah's Witnesses, "I do not accept transfusions." We've prepared a card, the Advanced Vaccine Directive card, which asserts your legal right to refuse vaccination. And if you want to get one of those cards and learn about it, you can go to this website. It's www.tinyurl, that's T-I-N-Y-U-R-L, tinyurl.com/ AVD Alpha Victor David, AVD card, AVD being Advanced Vaccine Directive. It says, "I do not consent," and it should be in your wallet. The general rule is if you present at an emergency room and you're not conscious, they're supposed to look through your wallet, your pocketbook or whatever to see if you have any medical warning cards. "I'm a diabetic. I'm allergic to penicillin. I refuse all vaccines." And they're supposed to note that on your chart. So that's that would overcome the case where the person is unconscious and can't object because it's right there. And so, again, tinyurl.com/ AVD card. That's an important weapon in your arsenal of protection from the potential for martial law during a declared pandemic. So
I think one of the big questions in this particular case is going to be based on the idea that the U.S. government has declared a certain state of emergency. That already happened a while ago with respect to this particular pandemic. And the U.S. is a member of the WHO, and it has also empowered the CDC to set aside certain constitutional rights if they declare a certain level of emergency. So when that happens and they're dealing with millions of people, you know, obviously before every one of them can get into a court situation, what's the practical reality of what's about to happen with that when it's not the governments per se that enforce these things on their own, but only as agents under the CDC, which is under the WHO, supposedly?
This will have to be tested in court. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
People are going to have to be ready to resist. Larry B. Craft said there are only two ways of resisting this sort of imposition. One is by taking up arms, which the Second Amendment gives us the right to do. And the other is by petitioning the courts, which the First Amendment gives us the right to do. They keep on not mentioning that. You know, the First Amendment bundles together freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom of association, and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances.
Yeah. What bothers me about that clause in the First Amendment is it gives you the right to do petitions. It doesn't tell them they have to respond.
The courts have held that the right of petition for redress applies to all levels of government. And no, they don't have to respond. But if you bring a petition before a court, there's a procedure. And the courts, and so that's the place to go. A petition to the president is something that doesn't have to be responded to. A petition to Congress, likewise. But a petition to the court, properly presented, is a legal action. And the courts will, one hopes anyway.
So this is a really important time for attorneys with courage and principles to actually try to help the people maintain their constitutionally recognized rights, I would imagine, right?
And one of those great lawyers that's doing that is Patty Finn of Rockland County, New York, the good health lawyer. She's done a great job. She's the first of the lawyers in New York to actually get an injunction against New York's draconian school vaccine law. And she did it within the context of what is called the learned intermediary, which is something you folks should hear about. The physician is the learned intermediary between the healthcare system and the individual. And what New York State tried to do when it abolished religious exemptions was to so restrict the doctor as learned intermediary that there would be no medical exemptions either. And in this particular case, the court issued an injunction because the government refused to accept the physician's decision as a learned intermediary that this particular child, who absolutely had the genetic markings of a person who would have an adverse reaction, this person was not a fit subject for vaccination. But unless you have a previous anaphylactic reaction to a previous vaccination, you can't get an exemption under the rules the way the New York State bureaucracy adopted them. The statute that was adopted didn't say that, but the rules that were adopted restricted the medical exemptions to only the list that the CDC has, which is essentially only anaphylactic shock. Right. Now, we have another government agency, the Institutes of Medicine, that Congress authorized to review vaccine safety, in fact, required it to do so. And the IOM has issued a series of reports, which the CDC has ignored, which list all of the adverse reactions that have been proven to vaccination. And it's a lot more than anaphylactic shock, let me tell you. We have two different government bureaucracies who are saying different things.
Right.
Who do you trust? Who do you trust?
We have enough material for many more shows. Let me ask you something for a really short answer because we've got about 1 minute left here. Is what happened in Samoa relevant to our lessons at all here? Because there they did go door to door. They jailed people who spoke out in favor of vitamins and things like that, put them in prison for false information, and forced everybody to have a medical treatment without consent. Is that relevant to what we're talking about?
Yes, it is. And the important difference is that we have a constitution here and a Second Amendment and a First Amendment. I have the right to associate or not associate. I have the right to say no. And we really have to remember that there's a little bit of American exceptionalism left. And unless we bend that at every step of the way, at every instance, they will remove our rights slice by slice. And all I can tell people is be careful, be prepared, be ready to self-shield at home. And make sure you have plenty of nano silver and assert your rights. If you do not assert your right, it is deemed waived. If you do assert your right to informed consent and are forced nonetheless, well, you probably have a legal action for damages at the very least.
We have a lot more to talk about.
You're done. All right. My pleasure always to be with you, and let's talk again soon.
Yeah, we will, Ralph. Thank you. Have a good night.
Good night.
Good night. All right. So we covered a lot there, and Ralph's an example of an attorney that I really appreciate, because he's just showing all attorneys all over our country, all over the world, in fact, that it's like Spider-Man movie said, right? With great power comes great responsibility, and everybody has a lot more power than we realize typically, and that gives us a lot more responsibility than we realize too. Just to have clear vision and to be an example of whatever you believe would help things get better in your everything that you do in your own life. So Ralph is working on a project right now that we're involved in, and trying to get real information to political people and people in positions of power, both politically and corporate, the ones who will listen to that, even all the way down to the local city and county level. And we'll see where this goes, but we have a narrow window to work in before all real information gets shut down under the justification of an emergency. And I think what Ralph was pointing out about that is that in the founding documents of the United States, the rights that are referred to don't come from the government. They don't come from the UN. They don't come from the health organizations. You have them just because you exist, from nature and from God, and it's not possible to suspend them. So, you know, none of this works. No system of government works unless you have a conscious population. So if we want to contribute to a better outcome, we really need to work on ourselves and, you know, not be out there just telling everybody else to do, but being an example in some way. And I think what Ralph is working on now is very important, because we're trying to get a message put together in a video format that would be concise and really well presented, hopefully, and coherent, and it would go over the important points in a very brief format, and it would go out to everybody that wants to see it. But a shortened form of it would also go to the president, the vice president, the members of Congress, everybody in the state, legislators in every state, school districts, media is mostly a lost cause, I know, but maybe them too, in case any of them is still willing to consider, you know, being honest and human being, and, you know, that sort of thing. So that's being worked on very quickly right now. And I would just suggest everybody, you know, learn how to take care of yourself, because as Pasteur and talked about near the end of his life, and Bichon talked about before that, it's not the microorganism or the germ, as they said, it's the terrain. The vast majority of people, even with this novel engineered lab created virus, recover from it. It's not the majority that die from it. So make your immune system strong. Don't eat garbage anymore. It's a really good time to stop doing that, in my opinion. You know, it's up to you, of course. And don't drink things that are bad for you. Don't smoke anything at all of any type whatsoever, and put all this garbage coating your lungs. That's not a good plan. Get enough sleep. Don't overlook that. It's not like a luxury. It's your body needs it to go through the cycle of rebuilding after you stress it out during the day and put, you know, muscle damage and organ damage, which happens every day, that gets repaired at night. So if you don't sleep at night, it doesn't get repaired. And that's called getting old really fast and getting a weak immune system. You want to avoid that. It would be a really good idea. So take care of yourself. That way you have a basis to be an example and try to share it with other people. Get sunlight. You know, that thing in the sky that they say will kill you because it's some kind of a mistake of nature or something. It wasn't really a mistake. It's not only good for you, it's essential. And in my experience, of course, talk to your doctor for all the real authoritative information. I'm just sharing my own experience with you. But in my experience, sunlight is critical. And as Ralph was talking about the nutrients that may be illegal to talk about soon, for the moment, he was able to mention D3, especially since none of us are getting enough sunlight. And if you have darker skin, you need even more sunlight. So D3 is critical, iodine and silver and 10 parts per million, 5 to 10 parts per million seems to be very effective against all these things. I can't tell you that, and I certainly wouldn't because I'm not a medical doctor. But medical doctors we've had on the show, like Dr. Labo, have mentioned, and I'm allowed to quote them, and they were saying it's effective against natural viruses and even some unnatural ones, which we've seen in the last few years. So it's a really good thing. And it can, on a big scale, any of you people from government that may be listening on, this is something easy and cheap to produce in mass quantities. Thousands of gallons of nanosilver could be made in almost no time. It takes distilled water, some silver rods, a little bit of electricity, and that's it. As I've really looked for negative effects of any kind, what they call side effects, which, you know, really, I don't see how the side word means anything. Negative effects, and I haven't been able to find any negative effects at all of nanosilver on that tiny concentration, 5 or 10 parts per million, but there's been amazing reports of good results from that. That could be spread all over the country and all over the world very quickly. Within a few weeks, everybody could have it. That would change the outcome dramatically. And where this information is being blocked and you know, censored as wrong information and stuff, it's not wrong, it's real. And I think that's why it's being blocked. So you need to help us get it to everybody you know. 10 parts per million, 5 to 10 parts per million nanosilver, which I'm not saying will do anything at all. Of course, I can't. I'm not even your medical doctor. But in my experience, you know, that's what it looks like it would do. And Dr. Labo, who is a doctor, has said that. So you might want to, excuse me, go back and listen to that show again with her talking. She was very good. And in case we disappear anytime soon, just in case we ever talk about anything controversial, which we're really trying to obviously completely avoid, as you can tell, then check out our channel on brighteon.com, brighteon.com/channel/LostArtsRadio. And if you want to be able to talk and be in a mutually supportive environment where I can talk about the research I've done without censorship and without any fear of that, go to planetaryhealingclub.com, and it's interactive and live. I'm there every week. The meeting for today is going to start in half an hour. For those of you that are already planning to be there, I'm looking forward to seeing you. And that's just like sitting around casually and talking about whatever we want with no restrictions, and it's nice. I don't do medical advice, obviously, or any other forbidden information there whatsoever, but still legal to talk about our experiences, and we've got some really unusual, powerful, valuable experience and knowledge to share with you there. That's planetaryhealingclub.com. If you want to keep us on the air, even though we don't do commercials or anything, donate at lostartsradio.com. There's a donate button there, and at lostartsresearchinstitute.org. We're trying to, you know, pay the bills and keep this thing going and expanding, and we need your help. Not if you're struggling to survive. Please don't donate anything then, except telling other people maybe what you learn. But if you have the resources, LostArtsResearchInstitute.org explains what we're doing more, and the school that we'd like to build if we get enough funding for it. We also have a Subscribestar page subscribestar.com/lostartsradio if you're interested in that. But I think the last thing I want to leave you with is that forum that we've created in a place that won't get censored as quickly, planetaryhealingclub.com. You're personally invited if you want specific information that you can use to deal with life and health situations that you're dealing with right now. And there's a lot to share. So for those of you interested, I'll see you there. Otherwise, tomorrow night, we've got a great show with Celeste Solem. Hope to see you there. And that'll be live, actually, which is unusual for the Sunday show. It's going to be really interesting and informative, and we'll carry the discussion on from where it went tonight. So anyway, sorry to be late. We're 4 minutes over. And really appreciate you letting us share all this stuff with you. We'll keep working at all the hours that we've got to bring you things that are not just about, oh, this is terrible and that's going on bad and all this terrible stuff's happening, but response, positive things that you can do that will be useful for you and the people that you care about. So take care of yourself, and that way you can help others and be an example for them. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for being here.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio on Subscribestar.com. Just go to Subscribestar.com/Lost Arts Radio to find our rewards program, offering 10 different giving levels starting at just $5 a month. We offer incredible value for any rewards level, from extra monthly interview videos not available publicly to subscription-based Planetary Healing Club videos once, twice, or three times a month, to private counseling sessions with Lost Arts Radio host Richard Sachs, to tech help with me, Doug Diamond. We even have one option where you can be the star on Lost Arts Radio as our guest on a specially produced show just for you. We conduct an interview with you and broadcast it to our growing network and listenership. Our Subscribe Star levels are one of a kind and offer great rewards for any budget. Please help support Lost Arts Radio. We can't do it without you. With increasing censorship on many of our channels, we really need your support today to keep doing what we're doing. As Richard says, we're not even at survival level yet. Lost Arts Radio has 3 weekly shows. Lost Arts Radio Live each Saturday night at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, which is a live stream currently on multiple platforms in case we get banned from some of the larger ones. Right now, we're on 2 YouTube channels, Facebook Live, Periscope, which is Twitter, Twitch, and DLive. You can access these broadcasts by going to www.lostartsradio.com/live for all the links to those channels. The Planetary Healing Club meets right after Lost Arts Radio Live at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. And our Sunday show with guests airs at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Sunday nights on our Blog Talk Radio channel, our YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and on Brighteon. Be sure to sign up for our free email list just in case we do get banned on big tech's platforms. It's just a matter of time, really. They don't like the stuff we talk about, and they do not want the truth out there. In fact, they have already attacked us numerous times. Join our free email list so we can let you know where we are and how to access our shows. The sign-up button is right on the top right on most pages of our website. The best starting point for all things Lost Arts Radio is our main site, lostartsradio.com, where you can find the hottest news selection videos that we curate just for you. Those are on the homepage and added to daily, as well as articles and breaking news about information you really need to know. Our show archives, the 10 most recent shows, are right on our homepage, as well as our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/lostartsradio, or just click the All Things Radio Show tab right on our website. We're in the podcast directory on iTunes, and all of our shows except the banned ones are on our YouTube channels at Lost Arts Radio and at Diamond Disc. Our Brighteon page is really taking off, and we often have editors' picks videos right on their homepage. Visit Brighteon.com/channel/Lost Arts Radio. On our site, you can also access our free listener forum as well as sign up for the Planetary Healing Club, which is just $25 a month, where you get private access to a one-on-one interaction with host Richard Sachs and myself and the other club members who participate live. More info can be found at PlanetaryHealingClub.com We're providing solutions in there to make the world a better place. Come join us. Thanks again for listening to and supporting Lost Arts Radio. We love having you as part of our family to learn, experience, and grow with.